in the next half hour, we speak with members of the Arab, Muslim, and South Asian communities around the country who have been harassed, detained, investigated, and deported in the wake of increased security and immigration control since September 11, 2001. You are listening to Under Attack, the Arab, Muslim, and South Asian community since September 11th, a collaboration between myself, Sarah Olson, and the Not In Our Name Project. While immigration has faded from the public eye, many in affected communities will tell you that what they see as draconian effects of the U.S. immigration policy are just now being felt. These are just a few of the stories of selective application of immigration policies and racial profiling.
For 10 months and 10 days, I was confined to a tiny underground grave. The screams of my fellow inmates filled my waking hours and remain with me to this day.
They knew that my children were Muslim and were raised Muslim and that there were dietary restrictions. And what they did was they placed them with a very Southern Baptist family who fed them pork chops and hot dogs.
The food you can even put in your mouth because the food got worms in the salad and the meat has got a smell.
Among many other things, the tragic events of September 11, 2001, marked a dramatic change in the United States immigration policies. Arab, Muslim, and South Asian communities have been particularly hard hit. Thousands of people have been deported, families have been visited by the FBI at all hours of the day and night, and individuals are being held indefinitely and without charges. Benafshe Eklagi is an attorney at Eklagi & Associates in San Francisco.
Upon the event of the day, that gruesome, gruesome day in the history of the United States, if not globally, that gruesome day resulted in the roundups of Muslim men the very day, within hours of the event. Right after that, we had disappearances of Muslim men and boys. So what did we do after that? The FBI started attacking all the mosques and rounding folks up for questioning. And the story kept going that way.
Legal experts like Eklagi say that the urgency of these events that began on September 11th has far from dissipated. Rather, the scars of the U.S. government policies are just beginning to be felt, and chilling new legislation has been signed into law. Reva Entine is a member of the National Lawyers Guild. For the first 2 years after September 11th, she managed a legal hotline advising people of their rights.
The thing that is unprecedented, and that's even given, you know, the Palmer raids and Japanese internment and those other horrible dark periods of history, which are dark, shameful periods of our history. But what has never happened before is that we can have people and citizens locked up indefinitely with no charges against them, no right to see a judge, and no right to see an attorney. That has never happened. So in all of these other times, people at least got to see an attorney, got to find the charges against them, and got to go before a judge. They might get convicted. They might get deported. But that basic due process, which is the backbone of our constitutional and judicial system, is gone. And that's what's unprecedented.
Arab, Muslim, and South Asian immigrant communities have been subjected to mass roundups, abusive detention conditions, secret hearings, and through the selective enforcement of existing immigration law, thousands have been deported. New waves of deportation are sweeping through communities. Many communities are terrified to speak out for fear of repercussions. Over 82,000 men and boys from 24 Arab and Muslim countries submitted to a new special registration program. 13,000 of these individuals are now slated for deportation. When hundreds of Iranian men and boys from Southern California were arrested while registering in December of 2002, people in the United States began to notice and took to the street in protest.
I can't stand by and do nothing as history repeats itself, as the crimes of the government lumber in front of us, just far enough to see and not quite close enough for the public to verify. We need to catch up with it, grab it by the neck, stare in the face and say, God damn it, I see what you're doing.
The greatest enemy is our own inaction.
120,000 Japanese Americans that 60 years ago during World War II, we were the ones that were uprooted, evacuated, and incarcerated in remote places in America. We do not want that ever to happen again to anyone else.
No human being is illegal. Ningún ser humano es ilegal.
But what the Bush administration has been doing, ostensibly in the name of national security, does nothing whatsoever to protect our country. Rather, what it does is it smears, it tarnishes, and it scapegoats.
They're demonizing entire communities, setting fear ablaze across the country, and fanning the flames of hate.
Hate crimes against those who looked Arab were on the rise after September 11, 2001. Within 1 month of the attacks, the Arab American Anti-Discrimination Committee logged more than 700 reported hate crimes. The Council on American Islamic Relations received nearly 800 reports. The U.S. Commission on Civil Rights Hate Crimes Hotline received 70 calls per hour in the weeks after the attack on the World Trade Center and the Pentagon. Many in the Arab, Muslim, and South Asian communities found themselves the target of law enforcement officials as well. Shaw, who is asked to use only his first name, is a United States citizen who was born in Afghanistan. He owns an auto shop in the San Francisco Bay Area. In December of 2001, he was on his way to Tahoe with two cars full of brothers and cousins. He was pulled over by the police and was accused of driving 110 miles an hour, a speed he claims he wasn't going. Shaw's brother was pulled out of the second car and handcuffed.
All of a sudden, out of nowhere, he says, if you talk to me too much, I'm going to have to take you to jail. And then he makes a comment, I quote, he says, believe me, with a name like yours, you won't be very famous in jail. At that point, I knew that he was looking at it as in a racial way.
Since Shaw believed he was not speeding, he challenged the ticket in court. At the court in rural California, Shaw says he was treated like a criminal before he had a chance to plead his case. He gave up, paid his fine, and was preparing to leave.
After I came to pay the fine, I saw a couple of police officers coming towards me and said that you guys got to go clean up the bathroom. I said, what do you mean clean up the bathroom? He says, well, what if you went to the bathroom and clogged up the toilet and now you got to go and clean it? So he had his hand on his gun, both of them. There's two of them. And while he was saying that, and I said, well, what if we don't? He says, we're going to make you to go clean it. So the way I looked at the situation, I just said, you know what? And then gave us something so we can go clean it. And they gave us a plunger and a few other things that we went in. I might add that they didn't even give us any gloves or anything. We just went there and cleaned up the toilet. Believe it or not, for a few days, I didn't even want to look at the food when I was, it was disgusting.
Shaw's case is emblematic of a larger trend. Many claim that September 11th allowed law enforcement officials to harass certain communities with impunity. Lynn Stewart is an attorney indicted by John Ashcroft for materially aiding a terrorist organization. Supporters say she is being prosecuted for simply being an effective attorney. Stewart says that there is a political motivation behind the attacks.
Well, every time the government has ever done this, starting with Abraham Lincoln suspending habeas corpus in the Civil War, up through the Japanese internments and the Palmer raids, it always has bounced back and they have said we were wrong. We didn't need to do this. This is what the government sells to the populace. We have to do these things because, you know, we need to protect you. I think it's even more insidious today because what the government is basically saying is we have to do these things not to protect you, but to make more money for us.
Ghassam Khalaf is a Palestinian and a dentist in San Francisco. He has been outspoken about his opposition to the Bush administration and to the war in Iraq. Last November, the FBI came to visit him at his office.
I was surprised to see the FBI in my practice at 10 o'clock in the morning, one morning in November. They claimed to be discreet, except that everybody noticed that they were here, and they were looking for bombs around my chest.
Ghassan was accused of being a suicide bomber, allegedly by an anonymous tip to the FBI offices. When the FBI showed up, they brought a bomb squad with them. Khalaf's patients were terrified.
I have lost some patients because whether they know what's going on or not, the fact that the FBI was here looking for bombs, whether it's true or not, it just scared people away, especially some of the members of the church I go to, because the word spreads around quickly. It reduces the patience because these people don't want to be associated with anything that has to do with the FBI or the government.
While the FBI claimed to be investigating a bomb threat, they also questioned Ghassan at length about his political beliefs. He was told that he should not have political material, like news magazines, in his waiting room. However, Khalaf defends his political opinions.
And I mentioned to them that people overseas, they die to get rights that we have here. They die. They kill themselves just to be able to vote and to have the freedom of speech. And we're giving this away freely.
Within the first year following September 11th, the FBI asked 8,000 Arab and Muslim men for voluntary interviews. In addition, thousands of people around the country, like Ghassan, have been visited at their homes and their offices. In January of 2004, the government launched the U.S. Visit Program, digitally photographing and fingerprinting millions of people who visited the United States each year on tourist, business, and student visas. Thousands of people complain about being harassed and profiled in airports. Samina Fahim is the executive director of American Muslim Voice. She says that she is often profiled while traveling.
In 1.5 hours, I have to go through security 3 times. So the third time when they just, you know, stopped me, I asked to speak with the supervisor. And when the supervisor came, I said, could you please tell me if the meaning of random has changed in the dictionary? He said, what do you mean? I said, because you guys say you do random checking. When you pick up somebody 3 times in 1.5 hours, how random is random?
Perhaps no one has experienced more extreme fallout from racial profiling at airports than Maher Arar. Arar is a Syrian-born Canadian citizen who was detained at Kennedy International Airport in New York City in September of 2002. Although his name came up on an international terrorist watch list, no law enforcement agency has been able to establish a connection between Arar and terrorist activity.
From the moment I was held in the United States, I was treated as though I were a convicted terrorist. I endured hours of interrogation. I was chained and shackled. My U.S. captors prevented me from seeing my lawyer for over a week and gave the Canadian consulate the runaround.
Arar was questioned in the United States for 1 week. During that time, he was denied almost all contact with a lawyer. He was denied food, strip-searched, insulted, and humiliated. Then he was blindfolded and flown by the U.S. government to Jordan, and then to Syria, where he was tortured for nearly a year.
My torturers beat me and interrogated me for hours on end. I was constantly threatened with further torture. They interrogated me about many of the very same issues my interrogators in the United States had. They asked me about my connections with the same people, and they asked me about my work in the United States. For 10 months and 10 days, I was confined to a tiny underground grave. I was rarely allowed out of that dark, damp hole. The screams of my fellow inmates filled my waking hours and remain with me to this day.
On January 22, 2004, Maher Arar, since released back to Canada, filed suit against Attorney General John Ashcroft, Homeland Security Secretary Tom Ridge, and FBI Director Robert Mueller under the Torture Victim Protection Act, signed into law by George Bush Sr. This is the first time that U.S. officials are being accused under the statute. Arar charges that these and other U.S. officials knew that he would be tortured when he was deported to Syria. You are listening to Under Attack, the Arab, Muslim, and South Asian community since September 11th, 2001, a collaboration between myself, Sarah Olson, and the Not In Our Name Project. For more information, visit www.notinourname.net or call 510-601-8000. Many individuals languish in United States detention centers without charges and without access to attorneys. In the first few months after September 11th, 1,182 non-citizens were detained, according to the American Civil Liberties Union. In the time since then, more have been rounded up. An investigation by the Inspector General of the United States cites abusive detention conditions in New York, and the Center for Constitutional Rights has sued the federal government on behalf of detainees. Benashe Akulagi works with some of the detainees in California.
The folks are placed in a cell that's 8x8, particularly at the beginning of registration. There were 40 in a cell, and these men and boys and senior citizens would take turns in who would stand and who would sit because there wasn't enough room. They're given, these folks are Muslim. Most of them are Muslim. They're being given pork-based products for food, and they're not able to consume it, obviously. They have been given each a thin medical style shirt, like a doctor's shirt and pants to wear. They are placed in lower than 60 degree conditions. They are harassed at the beginning of the registrations. An Afghani boy in San Diego had been taken into custody, and he was pushed from the second floor of the detention facility to his death. Within the detention facility, the backlash, the discrimination, the hate towards these men, these boys, these senior citizens, is immense. The cruelty from the officials themselves, as if these individuals have committed and perpetrated a crime. And their only crime is being born in one of those countries. Those are the conditions. They're inhumane.
Farouk Abdelmouti is a Palestinian and has been detained since April of 2002. He was questioned by the INS and the FBI about Al-Qaeda, Palestine, and Iraq. He says he was threatened and beaten by officials from the INS and the FBI.
He say, if you not collaborate, you don't work with us, we're going to send you to Mossad. We'll let you to Mossad, the Israeli intelligence. He mentioned Mossad. You know, and after that, hit me and threw me to the floor.
The Mossad is the notoriously brutal arm of the Israeli intelligence. Abdelmouti was instrumental in organizing a hunger strike in the Passaic County Jail, protesting the conditions there.
The food you can even put in your mouth because the food got worms in the salad and the meat has got a smell. You know, the dogs eat better and we are eating.
In addition to rotten food, Abdelmouti says that he and others were forced to stay in dirty, crowded conditions with poor ventilation and a broken bathroom.
The condition there for here was completely, you know, the place is dirty. You have in each dorm about more than 60 people. It have leak. The ventilation is not working. The bathroom is not working. This is all jail, you know.
In January of 2004, after nearly 2 years of imprisonment, a U.S. district judge ordered the government to explain why it continues to incarcerate Abdelmouti. That same month, the American Civil Liberties Union filed a claim with the United Nations stating that the United States' treatment of detainees violates international law. Farouk Abdelmouti was released from prison on April 12, 2004, after being held without charges for 718 days. it's hard to tell how many people have been detained as a result of the so-called War on Terror. Many of the deportations have happened in secret, with detainees being flown blindfolded and in shackles. 6,000 people have been prioritized for deportation under the Absconder Initiative because of their national origin. Another approximate 13,000 men and boys have been slated for deportation after the special registration periods in 2003. What we do know is that these deportations have destroyed families, are causing fear within impacted communities, and are not leaving the United States any safer from terrorism. Gerald David went to work in Deerfield, Texas, on the morning of March 1, 2002, and his wife Patricia has not seen him since.
They couldn't find no trace of my husband. My husband was in his system. They claim they look all in the holding cells and everything. At this point, we beginning to get worried on where my husband is, you know. So the lawyer called all the detention centers in the jails in New York, Baton Rouge, everywhere, looking for my husband. No trace of my husband. So I was at my job, and I received a phone call. And the phone call was from my sister-in-law in Pakistan. And she was just yelling my name, you know, Patricia, Patricia, Jerry's in Islamabad.
Gerald David was deported to Pakistan, wearing the same clothes he'd worn to work on March 1st, with no passport and with $22 in his pocket.
And on his trip to Pakistan, on the plane, he was telling me that they had him shackled. They had hands and their legs. They couldn't go to the restroom. My husband asked repeatedly to use the phone to call his attorney and to call me. They had like 100-some detainees in one room that only hold a capacity of maybe 15 people.
In his wake, Patricia and his daughter Jasmine are left to fend for themselves. Gerald was the family's primary source of income, and although Patricia has just finished college, she is still looking for a job.
We are having a really hard time trying to keep a place to live and keep transportation and deal with all the things that my husband dealt with when he was here, you know, like it's paying the bills and everything.
A business card belonging to Ashraf al-Jilani was found in the possession of someone arrested under suspicion of having al-Qaeda ties. Ashraf al-Jilani had been looking for a job and had passed out hundreds of business cards. Nevertheless, al-Jilani was arrested in October of 2002 when he went to work in Kent, Ohio. He has been held without charges ever since. This is his wife, Michelle.
It was about 9 o'clock in the morning. I got a phone call saying, this is the INS and we have your husband in custody. And I was totally shocked and I couldn't believe what was happening. And 5 minutes after I hung up, there was a knock at my door and there were 6 FBI agents standing there. So they came in and they spent like 8 hours searching my house, taking out boxes of documents, copying the hard drive on my computer. Then over the course of the next 6 months, I kept getting visits from the FBI saying, you know, various things. They wanted me to sign a document rescinding my support of my husband, which if I signed it, it would automatically deport Ashraf.
Next, Michelle's neighbors called Child Protective Services because they thought Michelle was depressed after her husband was arrested.
One night at 8 o'clock, there were 5 cops at my door. They knocked on my door and they came in and they said, we have a paper saying that you have to go to the hospital because you're depressed. You can either come with us willingly or we can put you in handcuffs and you can go that way. And I said, I can't go. I have 3 children sleeping upstairs. And they said, well, we have children's services outside, and they're going to take care of your children, so you need to come with us. So they took me to the hospital in the cop car, and they put me in the hospital for depression, and then they put my kids in foster care. They knew that my children were Muslim and were raised Muslim and that there were dietary restrictions. And what they did was they placed them with a very Southern Baptist family who fed them pork chops and hot dogs and took them to church every Sunday and every Wednesday. And my children came home, and my daughter said to me, I'm not going back to the mosque. I don't believe in that crap anymore. So I've had to reintegrate her into, like, Arab culture and Islam and stuff like that.
Michelle is also having financial trouble.
It's been absolutely devastating economically. I mean, Ashraf had a master's degree, and he was the one who went out and worked, and our bills were paid. We weren't rich, and we didn't have money left over, but at least all the bills were paid. and we had food to eat. And now I'm getting like $300 a month food stamps to feed my children. My kids need things for school, and I just can't give them the money that they need to take to school and, you know, gas for the car. There are times that we don't go anywhere just because I don't have money to put gas in my car. And, of course, none of the bills get paid. They just come in the mail and I throw them away because there's just no way I can make payment on those with no income.
A judge has ordered Ashraf released twice, and the government has appealed his release each time.
Feu a brûlé le printemps. Arrêtez de faire la guerre. Vous faites la guerre à des enfants.
Reva Entine says we are irrevocably altering the laws and the power in the United States, and she questions whether we are fully aware of the ramifications of the changes to the legal system.
The balance in this country is based on the balance of powers between the three branches of government. Everything that's going on from the Patriot Act giving more power to the executive branch and all of these executive orders are really having it so this country has only one branch. And I believe that Congress is abdicating its responsibility and the judicial branch is being left out. They don't have to be consulted in terms of a lot of these searches, and there doesn't have to be probable cause for people to be investigated. And that to me is the scariest part of what's going on, is that when laws are wrong, when actions are wrong, there are other branches that are to evaluate it. And if those two branches are no longer relevant and everything is in the power of the executive branch, that really is a sign that we're moving towards fascism.
While the so-called war on terror continues, Banafshe Akhlaghi wants to know if what is happening in the United States is making us any safer.
The thing that we fear the most, which is another attack on this country, is I think what we are creating within the targeted groups in this the communities within this country. We've created such fear. We've created such isolation. We've created such hatred for themselves and for the country that they're in. Is this the way to bridge the gap? Is this the way that we want to have this targeted group come forward and assist us in security measures by oppressing them, by rounding them up, by detaining them, by deporting them, by ripping them away from their families? Is this the means that we're using to seek information from a possible second attack?
Attorney Lynn Stewart says that we must foster resistance to these events.
I do feel that the government will reach out. It always reaches out to be more and more centralized, to be more and more in control, to not have to consult with the governed. And certainly in the days following 9/11 and right up to the present, there is one political party in this country. There is one way that they're going to do things, and there is very little opposition except in the streets. And that's why we have to stay in the streets. It's most important.
This has been a special production in collaboration between myself, Sarah Olson, and the Not In Our Name Project. For more information, see www.notinourname.net or call 510-601-8000.